Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome and good morning. It's Casey Grant, and this is the Fly Girl Show. And as I always say, I have a fabulous show for us today. Today is an exciting interview with Zelly Orr, who is a Mississippi civil rights pioneer and barrier breaker, historian, author, and researcher. Now, with all that being said, we are going to touch a little bit on everything, but the most exciting story I'm waiting for is she's going to give you the black version of being our Indiana Jones. Now, I say that just to tease you, and then we're going to lead into what that all means. So let me finish my introduction on Zelly. Zelly was the first woman, which in 2011, she was the first woman to be elected president of the Atlanta chapter of the Tuskegee Airmen. She had also served as the national historian for the Tuskegee Airmen in 2010. And with all of that, that just kind of leads me right back to the Indiana Jones version, which she is going to tell us the beginning and the end and the mystery of how she uncovered something that the Tuskegee Airmen had been denied the acknowledgement of, the accolades. And so I could go on and on and on. And I am just so excited. I just want to get this show going. So with that, it's time for me to introduce you to Zelly Orr. Good morning, Zelly. How are you doing?
Good morning, Casey. I am well. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Well, you know, you wear many, many hats, but have you ever worn an Indiana Jones hat before?
No, that was good. I love that. I'll have to use that one. I love the pitch, and I had not even thought of it that way. So thank you for awakening me to that kind of a life, okay?
Oh, my goodness. I'm just so excited. So tell the people, give up my audience an introduction to you and who you are, where you're from Indianola. I said that right, right?
Yes,
Mississippi.
Indianola. Most people.
Okay, so please start. The floor is yours. Please give my audience an introduction as to who you are and what you have done.
Okay. I was born in Indianola, Mississippi, and it is the hometown of B.B. King. He is actually buried there. There is a museum that honors him in Indianola. And while growing up in Indianola in 1967, for the first time they decided to try integration. They sent 5 students to the all-white high school. I was one of those students. And I went to that same summer, I got to go to Chicago for a visit and attend summer school and take a class there at Parker, I think it would have been Parker High School. But so Indianola would lead me to Chicago. I have some relatives there that you might know, Richard Pegee, who was a DJ. And
oh,
Richard
yes.
died a couple of years ago. Yeah, he was my cousin. But so back to... Then after growing up in Mississippi, when I graduated high school in 69, I moved to Los Angeles, and I lived there for 10 years. I went to Los Angeles City College to study journalism and also pursued my bachelor's at San Fernando Valley State College. And ironically, actually just realized some years ago that I had gone to an airline school, and that was in 1972. And I was actually going not to become a flight attendant, but to become like a reservation clerk, anyone on the ground. Those are what the positions were that I would be trained for. But, of course, after the nine-month course, I never, ever got an interview with any of the airlines. But that was perhaps a blessing because that's where my journey in journalism really had its beginning.
Okay. Well, let me make a comment about that school, because at that time, back then, that's exactly how a lot of those schools got people. And they said, you know, we're training you for, especially for the flight attendant, as they were known back then, it was stewardess. But they would train you to be a stewardess. And that had nothing to do with anything, you know, because the airlines were like, oh, yeah, great, you took a course, but we want to train you our way. So they took a lot. They almost took my money. It was going to be $600. To go. And my father said, well, we'll scrape it together if you really want to go. But $600 out of a family budget was an awful lot of money.
And you're so right. I end up spending $1,200. And I look this way. Like I said, mine was to become a reservation clerk, but perhaps my life would have taken a whole different path had I gotten into the airlines, because I just admire you guys, women and men who got to see the world and get paid. But had I been doing that, I might not have ever gotten on the path of research the way I did.
Mm-hmm. What inspired you to go into research? I know the history about the Tuskegee, that you're basically their official historian. But what was the first thing that enticed you to go into that field?
In 1999, I brought together a civil rights reunion in my hometown. I'm from Sunflower County. That's the county, anyway, that Indianola is in. And a lady named Fannie Lou Hamer is from that county. We had never had a civil rights reunion. And remembering my getting to march and stuff like that with her, 35 years later, this is in 64, that happened with Ms. Hamer and all. But anyway, in 1999, when I brought together the Civil Rights Reunion, a white reporter that was there said, this is great what you're doing with civil rights, but what about your pilot that was killed in combat? And I had never heard, of course, in a little town of like 12,000 people, that we had a black pilot. So he knew the man's name. He said it was Quitman Walker, but he didn't know the family. And actually, I did not know at the moment who the family was when he said Quitman Walker. So I told my mom about it, and my mother, who still lived in Indianola, said, well, that is probably the son of Miss Walker, who lives on Church Street. She's got a picture on her mantle of her son who died in the war. And my mother and all just called it the war. And this was in 99. In 2000, when I did try and contact Ms. Walker, found out she was deceased. And someone led me to her daughter. And the daughter lived in Memphis. So that's where my research began. I just really, in finding out the pilot died in combat, I thought he was buried in Indianola, that I would take flowers to the grave and place them there. But his sister would inform me that she didn't know where he was buried. And that's where the research began. I decided to try and find out where Quitman Walker is buried. And Quitman is buried in Nieuwpries, Belgium. And that is actually in locating his remains and getting him all his medals and awards. It ended up where the next thing that would happen, somebody else at the Tuskegee Airmen would share more with me. So that began my research, is locating the body of an airman that's still buried overseas.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to go through this whole interview, I know, with my mouth open, and I'm going to stumble and bumble. So my audience, please excuse me if I sound like I am just so thrilled to hear this adventurous story. So from that, what did you do that led you to the Tuskegee, becoming their historian and being so in love with the history?
I'm going to say this. Some things we are decreed to do, not degreed.
Yeah.
This was a decree on my life, and I can say that authentically, because I'm living in Marietta, would locate, and locating Quitman Walker's body. I decided to do some research about, you know, now that I'm hearing Quitman Walker, the Tuskegee Airman, I never even knew the word Tuskegee Airman.
Yeah.
So I was looking for a black pilot from my hometown. So someone led me, I'm living in Marietta, to call the Atlanta chapter. And when I called Atlanta chapter Tuskegee Airmen organization, they put me in touch with Colonel Dryden, Charles A. Train Dryden. So when I called Colonel Dryden and explained to him what I was trying to do about Quitman Walker, that I had no pictures, I was actually trying to find something about him in books, I said I only found one book that listed his name, that he was a pilot. And Colonel Dryden said, Quitman Walker of Indianola, Mississippi, I have a picture of Quitman. And I was floored. I mean, this is just really how it's like pieces just falling into place like a puzzle. So he invited me, Colonel Dryden, to come to his house. I go to Colonel Dryden's house, and he's talking to me about Quitman, how he was handsome, a handsome young man, and all of that. And sure enough, that's when I saw the first picture of Quitman. And got to hear about Tuskegee Airmen, you know. And, of course, Colonel Dryden explained to me, because in his hallway, he pointed and said, and these were the Top Gun. I had no idea what he meant. And on his wall was actually a picture of the three pilots that won that Top Gun competition. And so I informed him about how I had gotten for Quitman all of his medals posthumously, and that Columbus Air Force Base was going to honor him and had invited me to come and speak on this two-day event. Again, I'm a civilian. My relatives who were in World War II, like the Tuskegee Airmen, were Army. So my uncles never even talked about the war. But the short of it is, Colonel Dryden says to me, well, if you're going to Columbus Air Force Base, you're going to meet Albert Temple. And, of course, I'm like, Albert Temple, he says, he's one of the Top Gun. And he points to him on this picture in his hallway. He said he lives in Columbus, so I'm sure he's going to be at that event. And he was. And that's what I learned is from the event, is that Colonel Temple talks about how the trophy is missing. And to be honest with you, again, I had no idea how large this trophy was or anything, because in the hallway, Colonel Dryden's picture was only the men in their uniform. It didn't have a picture of the trophy. So I assumed this trophy was just, you know, a trophy 12 inches high. But anyway, when Colonel Temple, whom I met in Columbus, told me that he had cancer, he was in a wheelchair, such a humble man. And at this event, there was Eugene Carter, Luke Weathers, there were about five Tuskegee Airmen, so it was truly an honor to meet them, along with Mrs. Carter, one of the women who was flying planes in World War II. She didn't fly for the military, but Mildred Carter had her civilian license. But getting back to the story, when Albert Temple shared that they didn't know where the trophy was, it didn't strike up anything in me. I just figured, oh, okay, this doesn't mean much. Again, I don't know much about the Tuskegee Airmen history. But 6 months later, something just inside of me, there was this desire to say, you know what, this man was so kind. Maybe I can find the trophy. So I called their house, and like I said, this is 6 months after the event in Columbus. And his grandson answered and said, he's not home. And I said, well, okay, I'll call back tomorrow. And he said, well, I don't know if he'll be coming back home, because, you know, he's really sick. I said, you know, so can I speak to your grandmother? And he said, no, anyway, she's at the hospital with him. But I did call back the next morning thinking, oh, she'll be back home. I'll tell her what I want to do. So when I called, and this time the grandson says, no, she's not here. And I explained, he said that he found that they won a trophy. He has not seen it in 50-something years now. Mind you, they won it in 49. I met him in 99. So this is actually 50 years. And I said, so I don't know what I'm even looking for. Do you know if he has a newspaper or anything? And the grandson said, hold on. He said he keeps a copy of the newspaper from that event on his dresser. And he goes over, and I told him, I need three things. Can you give me the date it happened? Where it happened? Because I didn't even know, you know, again, I'm civilian. He said, it says the paper's from Lockbourne Air Force Base, May 12th, 1949. And I said, you know, and again, I don't even see a picture of it, right? So So I just started looking up as far as on Googling and everything, and then contacting via phone calls different bases, Air Force bases, inquiring about a trophy. And places said they didn't have anything, and one place, which was Maxwell, said, send me a letter, which I sent them that same day. So this is a Monday in 99. I ended up finding the trophy. I'm sorry. It ended up being in 99, but I ended up locating that trophy, but I went looking for it. It only took me about 5 days.
Well, before you go into that, because I do want to hear the details. I'm a detailed person. I want to know everything. But for my audience, let me just kind of interject something. The Tuskegee, because everyone knows Tom Cruise, and I wrote in my book, Stars in the Sky, I did give this history because I discovered this in doing research for my book, and I just had never heard of it. And to back up even further, Zelly, I'm from Chanute Air Force Base. Obviously, for those who know anything about Tuskegee Airmen were at Chanute Air Force Base, the mechanics and so forth. I personally knew a Tuskegee Airman, but we did not know anything about it. It's just I knew that, Richard Hall was another military person, but I never knew anything about Tuskegee Airmen either. So we were all pretty ignorant to that. So for the audience, we're backing up. The movie Top Gun is one thing. The real Top Gun people, the very first competition was in 1949, the Air Force competition. So I believe I'm correct in stating that John Bailey, who is our dear friend, he and I had talked about it, and he had given me some insight on it, which is how I got to meet you, thank heavens for my good old John. And so we're talking 1949 is when this competition took place, and the Air Force never acknowledged it. So, audience, we're talking 1949 to really, Zelly, you discovered the trophy in 1999, but the government did acknowledge it in 1993 is what my research showed, and it was brought – from Harvey, one of the original pilots, right? Can you fill us in on what I've just introduced?
Yeah, and let me correct something. See, that's why, because I have so much that I do, and I have to write this down.
Yeah.
I learned about, anyway, I actually, it was 2004 that Whitman Walker's Columbus Air Force Base found out what I did in locating his body. That's what it was. It was in 2004 that they found that out. And I had gotten medals, and they said, look, well, we want to do a formal presentation. So anyway, it was actually 2004 that this happened, that I got a chance to meet Colonel Temple. And in August of 2004 is when I contacted him and found out, you know, about the verbiage on the newspaper article, right? So we're talking about really had been 55 years that the trophy had been missing. And the whole thing is now, once I went looking in August of 2004 on a Monday, that Friday is when I got a response. And this response came from Maxwell Air Force Base saying, we've got a picture, but we don't know where the trophy is. So they didn't know where it was. Then I got another response that same day because I had sent something to the museum in Dayton, Ohio, the National Museum of the Air Force, okay? And they responded that they had the trophy. So on that Friday, I find out that they have the trophy. Of course, I'm so excited. I look at the phone number on that correspondence. I call right away, all excited about the trophy. I said, you know, and I spoke with the gentleman, the historian, and said to him, look, I want to let the airmen know, and I would love to come and see it, because they haven't seen it since 1949. And that historian was Underwood, Jeffrey Underwood. He said to me, well, the trophy will never be displayed. It's in storage. And, you know, again, not being military, I did understand one thing. Why would a trophy that was so important be in storage? So I, of course, when Colonel Temple died, now, so like I said, on Monday, I call the house. The grandson gives me this information. Colonel Temple died that Sunday.
Oh.
Just that before, you know, I had called. After that call and all, he died. It was as if he was waiting for somebody to do this pursuit, because I would go to the funeral. Now, again, this is still 2004, and when I went to the funeral of Colonel Temple is when I carried with me the correspondence from the Air Force Museum saying they had the trophy, because Mrs. Temple invited me to come and said that Harry Stewart would be there. Harry Stewart was one of the other primary pilots that flew in that competition. So Harry Stewart was there. I show him the picture of the trophy, and he becomes, you know, emotional and said, that's our trophy. And I told him what I had been told me, that the trophy will never come out. And he said, Miss Orr, we'll do all we can to help you get that trophy out. So that's in August 2004. By December 2004, the Air Force Museum agrees, we will do one thing. We will bring the trophy to an event in Detroit. This is where Harry lived. And at the time, there were only of those three primary pilots, Temple, Stewart, and Harvey, only two were alive, Stewart and Harvey. So in December, when I go to Michigan, where Stewart lives, for this event, Harvey is not there, because he's already planned a vacation out of the country. But Stewart was there, and so was the crew chief, Buford Johnson. So that is the first time that trophy was seen again. It came out of storage, got all polished up, beautiful trophy, 3 foot high. Amazed me. I didn't even realize how large it was.
Okay.
Okay, so that was the first time the trophy ever came out. Now, they brought it. You know, of course, I got to be invited to that event in December, but that trophy went back. It was only there at the event that one day, roped off, all of that. I mean, it became so special, and it went back into storage. So, again, my pursuit was, please, you know, why won't you leave it out? And finally, in 2006, not in 2005 at all, but in 2006, during Black History Month, I was told by the general that was over the museum, Metcalf, he said that we will have it out for Black History Month, and they plan to put it back in storage. But after that day in February of 2006, they left it out. So it actually was 57 years, and then they had an event. Again, I wrote a book about it where I said, look, Harvey has not seen the trophy. He didn't get to see it in 2004 in Detroit. Will you at least have an event, since it's now out in 2006, and invite all the participants who were a part of that gunnery competition? Okay? And that's when Harvey and Stewart, the two blacks, got to see it, the primary pilots. Buford Johnson was also present, and I got to go. But let me just get the story straight so people understand. That trophy was an Air Force trophy. There were 12 teams that competed in 1949, and on that trophy are the names of the winners of the jet class, because 7 teams flew jets, 5 flew conventional, which were the propeller aircraft that the Tuskegee Airmen flew. So the Tuskegee Airmen won for the conventional class, and the 4th fighter group won for the jet class. They both share the trophy. Their names are on the base.
All right, I can breathe now. I cannot. So let me ask you this. Why did it take you 5 days? Because when I wrote it up, Zelly, I had you climbing and digging and dust and dirt and everything else and trying to find this trophy. Why did it take you 5 days to find it?
That's why I was trying to explain about how can I tell people when one has a decree on their life.
Yes.
The fight for me was not the finding. The fight for me was its repose, because the historian Underwood said to me, it will never come out of storage.
Yes.
So that the issue became, why won't you share the trophy?
Yes.
Why won't you show? And he said to me, it wasn't the conventional pilots that were important. It was a jet class. He said, because, you know, we're starting to fly jets. So the Tuskegee Airmen, he didn't say Tuskegee Airmen, he just said the conventional winners, that trophy really wasn't important. It's about the jets. And I said, and again in my book, I don't want to revisit and rewrite history, because they're both of their names are on the trophy. Obviously, they were both equally important. So why not put the trophy out and let these men see it, including the fourth fighter, you know, the jet class winner.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I'm still listening. Yes.
So that's where, now, this is why I had to write a book. And like I said, you're right, Indiana Jones, yes. And this is where all the pieces fall. Most people thought it was finding the trophy. For me, it was getting the story right, because once I located the trophy, and the airmen had told me that they refused to acknowledge them. You know, there was an Air Force magazine. It's true. And this Air Force magazine came out like 1986. But it listed the jet class winners. It says 1949. There's a list of all the winners, 49, 1950. Now, they didn't have a meet 51, 52 because of the Korean War. Then they started listing the 53, 1954 winners. But the 99th, who won that trophy, or not the 99th, the Tuskegee Airmen, the 332nd, were not in that 1996 magazine. And that's where the story became, they never included us. And it's true, they didn't include them, but they've got the Ford Fighter Group that they won in 1949. And that's why in my book, as you would see too, I go, why, what, something's wrong with the story. And that's where one of the pilots would correct that, so that the Air Force magazine, because he knew something I didn't know, he knew the people to reach out to that had documents.
Oh.
And they got them included. But, yeah, so that's the whole thing, is that the 1949 winners were acknowledged later, but they acknowledged in the Air Force magazine only the jet winners who were white.
Okay.
Now,
well,
okay,
once again, first of all, Tuskegee Airmen, they were late in getting the recognition worldwide. But you know what's so fabulous about this is that you not only were given that mission in life to discover all of this and to let the story be known, and now, thank goodness, I have you documented on my show. I wish I had known you when I was writing the book, because I did write what I had was able to discover through all of my research, but I really wish I had known you, because it would have been so much of more in-depth story, but that's okay. We're going to cover it in my next book, and we're also getting it live from the horse's mouth, Indiana Jones, everybody, in color for the Tuskegee Airmen. And so we're getting it straight from you, and I'm so glad that you took it upon yourself to accept the mission and were driven to do that, because they needed to be recognized. And what a pleasure to be able to show. I never knew that they even saw the trophy, so I was glad to hear you say that.
Yeah, that's what helped me to, in those 5 days when I finally got a picture that I could see, because remember when the grandson that Monday read to me the date of the newspaper, where it came from, I didn't see a picture. I still had no idea where this picture of the trophy. So that's why in my calls I could say at least, you know, they wanted this day, and anyway, who the names of the men are, because he read that to me, you know, that the three primary pilots who flew, there was a fourth, alternate. He didn't fly. It was a 10-day competition. The alternate pilot, Harvey Alexander, didn't fly. But he is certainly in that picture and worthy, because to be selected to participate, they use the scores of the highest, like at the 332nd, they had participated in a gunnery competition themselves, just among themselves. And so they chose the highest scores of those 332nd men, four of them, that will compete. Every team had four men. One was called an alternate. So sometimes, like in the Tuskegee Airmen side of it, only three would fly, okay, Harvey, Stewart, and Temple. But the short of this whole thing is, it made them really special, is that there's another piece of the story. That's why mine is told. The airmen, it was a 10-day competition. One of them got to fly in an F-82, and an F-82, as you probably know, has the double fuselage, so you could have two pilots fly. They were not flying that type of aircraft. Whites were, but they allowed a black man from the 332nd, a crew chief, Buford Johnson, to fly in one of those seats. Of course, he wasn't a pilot, and he enjoyed the rocketry competition, you know. So he came back and told his made on the ground. Oh, wow, that was a great experience in this plane. So the next day, they let this gentleman go up. And unfortunately, he died. The plane crashed. And there was actually one who died during that meet. That was a Tuskegee Airman, of course, with a white pilot. And so I decided to, and I'm trying to think of his name. This is where I'm getting, well, I'm grabbing my book right quick. But he ended up, as a result of that crash, and the Tuskegee Airman died, and the white pilot, the men said we had been there then, this or by 8 days. We had not had a break. This is the ground crew working on the planes, keeping them ready. We decided to go to the Flamingo Hotel and just have a drink. He said, we just wanted a drink. And they went into that hotel and were shouted out, you know, you're not welcome here, that kind of a thing. So yes, they went back and they won that competition. That's what makes it special. They overcame an obstacle of a great loss where they were already being segregated, you know, at Lockmore, and they were still black. This is where they were, you know, based now, no longer at Tuskegee in 49, but at Lockmore in Columbus, Ohio. So they're already discriminated against. Now they go to a competition. Their friend is killed. They go to just have a drink, and they're wearing their uniforms. And here it is at that hotel. They cannot even go in and enter, you know, they're, yeah, without being shouted out. So it's really, you know, and then the next day, oh, the irony of the story, the next day is when the competition was ending. They had another competition to see who would be the high scorers, and that's when the Tuskegee Airmen, the 332nd, won the conventional meet, and they presented them the trophy and all of this at the Flamingo.
Oh, my goodness. Irony is the funniest thing. Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, you speak of the segregation and the obstacles that the military people went through. My father was Air Force, as I said. And in my book, I write about the different encounters that he had. And one of the things that he told us was that his name was Eric, and he would apply for different things, and he was accepted because they didn't know if he was black or white. Had he known he was black, he wouldn't have been accepted in different jobs or different positions that he wanted. And so he lived, and he knew the discrimination that was displayed in the military. I, being a dependent, was sheltered by it because of all the different things. I started school in England and lived in Africa. And for my whole childhood life, it was just a matter of us being American. Anybody who spoke English, we were just happy to know. So my father knew all the discrimination. I never did. I'm sure, you know, our friend John Bailey has his stories because being a pilot in the military and then also captain for Delta Airlines, he can tell us, he can come on, and he has been on and has given us some of the stories of discrimination that he felt. But that is poetic justice, that they would present the flag, the trophy at the Flamingo Hotel. That is too funny.
Yeah, and B.O. Davis, of course, came from Lockbourne to the event. And as Buford Johnson, who was present for all of this, he's the one told me about his friend. Matter of fact, that gentleman's name was Kenneth Austin that died during the competition. So that's what I also want to highlight, is that someone lost their life, you know, just part of it during the competition. But when B.O. showed up, they said, you know, they were thinking, this is Buford saying, you know, to me all these years later, we were wondering, could we really go in the Flamingo? And we, you know, he said, we get in there because we hear that's where the presentation ceremony is going on. Now, the other piece to this, when they, the four men, you probably seen, you've seen a picture, I'm sure, of the men with the trophy. Have you seen a picture?
Yes, okay. I have. I have it displayed on the website.
Well, on there was also the presentation for the jet class. So this one trophy. Okay, well, this tall trophy, which is a top honors trophy is what they really call it in the write-up in the papers and all, that they won top honors, you know. But anyway, this top trophy is the same trophy you'll see that the jet class winners Four of them were also pictured with. And their names are on the piece, okay, along with the 1950 winners, right? So 1949, this very trophy is an Air Force trophy supposed to go to the Pentagon. The next year, the next winners, their names would be added. And sure enough, their names were added. However, and I'm saying it like this, however, you're talking about Indiana Jones, when I found the trophy or located the trophy, when I was told the trophy is at the museum that August of 2004 on a Friday, and that, you know, of course, is in storage, but they sent me a picture. I saw the 1950 winners. So I asked them, well, where are these people? You know, where are they? Because they, too, might want to see this trophy. So as I'm fighting to get the trophy out, I contact this the fourth fighter group. I could never get any correspondence because I wanted to see a picture of them. Now, So we got whites and blacks who shared this trophy in 1949. In 1950, the top of the trophy is different. Okay, see what I'm saying is that this same trophy that you look at today,
yeah,
that had the names on that base where the black men are, it has the name of the 1949 jet and conventional winners, and it has the name of the 1950 jet and conventional winners. However, my research turned up about 6 months ago, thanks to my finding the daughter of one of the 1950 winners who sent me their picture with the trophy, and the trophy has not a man standing on top, a figurine of a man. It has actually a jet aircraft. So now and the trophy, if you go to the museum today, the one I located that has their names on it, the top of the trophy is missing. In my book, I inquire, where is the top? Because, see, in 1949, I just wanted to make sure the top was also there. And I get a response, and it's in my book, and it's an email. See, my book is full of emails, so it wouldn't be she said, he said. I just took off the name, okay? And the gentleman says, we checked Ms. Orr back in the box where the trophy is kept. There is no top with it, okay? So now I'm wondering, that trophy that is on display today, the cup, obviously the big piece belongs, you know, goes with it, but the top is different for the 1950 winners. So why are both names on the same trophy if it's not the same one?
Indiana Jones, you got to take your hat out and dust it off. Because
go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I said because that is now the thing that I want to know, and I believe as the airman, I'm so grateful I got to meet these Harvey and Stewart. Harvey's name is correct on the trophy, his rank, but Stewart's rank is that of a promotion a year later, and I said to them that I think what I'm finding out now. Is they really just added their name to this trophy in 1950, that the base that has their names, like at the time Stewart flew in 49 with his group, he was a lieutenant. Now it shows that he is, let me make sure it says, I'll go back at the book, I'm going to say that. Oh, he's now a captain. Let me go back, I have to go back to my book right quick. And, but anyway, it shows him with the promotion. He said, I didn't get that promotion in 49. I got that as I was leaving. I think what it is, the trophy that I located with the 1949 and 1950 winners, that they actually added the 1949 winners' names. I really believe they may have left their names off and never intended to put their names on the trophy. Because Because if you had in 1950, you had the same competition. It was they're flying jets and conventional class. The 1950 winners are listed. Their ranks are all perfect. But the Tuskegee Airmen, the 332nd, is the only one whose ranks are a year old later. Because matter of fact, Temple in 1949 was Captain Albert Temple, but the trophy says he is a major. And like you said,
my.
So it never ends. It's that's one thing about research that I'm now trying to explain to especially minorities. It is so important to read and be a critical thinker.
Yes.
Because information, you know, check out many pieces.
Yes.
And then you try and come up with your, quote, assessment or conclusion.
But, you know, the first word of what you just said, not research, read. Read. You have to go and do your research and read. It's so interesting. But I want to ask a question. Now, when the Tuskegee Airmen received their awards in the White House, did any of this information surface? Was the trophy at the White House with them? Because they received their congressional medals.
Yeah, they received the congressional medals. I was a part of the committee, and I'm honored. We tried to get them there. You know, I got to 10, but the short of it is that when they did go, that was in 2007, is that we were trying to get the trophy, which was now on display at the Air Force Museum. They claim that because it is sterling silver, it's pure silver, they claim, we cannot let it touch the air. We cannot let this happen to it and that, and unless there is a certain type of security where it's in a in this temperature-controlled environment, we cannot let it be shown there. So they wouldn't let it come to D.C., but if you look in the pictures of the people on the podium with the president, with George Bush and all, there is also Harry Stewart. And that was a role I played in saying, well, you guys, you need to get one of the men that won that competition to be on that program.
Okay.
So sure enough, they had a ground crew, and, of course, they had, Roscoe Brown, Lee Archer, you know, the really renowned men. But Harry Stewart shot down 3 planes on April 1st, 1945. And I said, and then he would go on to become a Top Gun pilot. Please put one of them on the stage. And they did. Out of he and Harvey, the last two Top Gun that were alive, Stewart was the one on program, but not the trophy. They would not, the museum would not have it, you know, on display.
Well, you know, what you have said and told us a story of is what you don't know, because no one had any idea, the general public, we had no idea about the trophy. These men knew that they had won this trophy, and I guess they just went on about their lives and just said, oh, well, because fighting the government is a very hard thing to do. We all know that. But the secrets, it's the secrets. And now you're talking about two toppers. The secrets that's behind all of this, that the racism is still there.
Yes, for sure, because like I said, when I, you know, to be told that the trophy didn't matter as far as these men winning it, the conventional class, that wasn't important, when I said, you know, I'm talking to the airmen who won it, they would love to see the trophy again, you know, can they come and see it? And that's when I'm told, oh, no, it will never be displayed. And the gentleman, like I said, said, they, you know, it was about the jet winners, and I had to correct him. Let's not revisit history. History has their names on equally with the jet class. So that means they were all important.
Absolutely. The recognition that was so overdue. 55 years later, actually longer than 55. I mean, you discovered everything about 55 to 57 years later. But it was ongoing until 2004, and really you're still researching and still trying to get the full picture completed.
Yeah, because I got a chance to send the trophy, the picture that I now have, that the family in 2000 member who won that trophy in 1950, part of the conventional class. Here it is. They're standing with the trophy. I mean, it's a beautiful trophy, same cup. When I say cup, that card without the top on it, that figurine, it's exactly the same. But what is different, and it's clearly there, it is a jet plane. As if, even though they have the 1950 jet and conventional winners, as if they said, well, we're just gonna put the jet on here, even though you had people who flew propeller aircraft too in 1950 that won. So my whole thing is, like I said, all I want to know truly is whose trophy is this? I mean, is this from the 1950? And they inadvertently wanted to make sure the Tuskegee Airmen got included, because like I'm looking at what it says for the 1949 winners on that trophy, it shows Major Albert Temple. He was a captain then. He said, I had not even gotten the rank of major in 1949. And it shows it is Major Stewart. And he had not even, I mean, he's Captain Stewart then, but he was a lieutenant when he won. So
yes.
I think their things were inadvertently added in 1950. And that trophy, which is still there, they definitely deserve to say it's theirs. But my thing is, come on, let's just get this right.
Absolutely. Secrets. So once again, tell us the name of your book so people can research that, because I'm definitely going to read your book because I want this story to really penetrate in my mind. I want to get it right. And also, once again, the trophy is displayed at, it's in Ohio. So tell my audience all that information too should they want to go visit.
The National Museum, NMUSAF, for the National Museum of the United States Air Force, and that is in Dayton, Ohio.
Okay. And you know what? My uncle was a colonel at that base when I was a little kid, so, I mean, it wouldn't have been anything for me to go and look at the museum. There was no interest at that point, but it would have been so interesting to know if he even knew anything about it way back then.
Well, you know, the airmen actually, like they said, when I say the airmen, the winners, said they looked for the trophy at the Pentagon because that's what were told it would be kept.
Oh.
And then every year, the next competition, you know, to be awarded to the next winners. But as there were too many names to be placed on the base, that subsequently there would be a scroll that would contain the names of all the winners. But some of the airmen actually were stationed there. They told me that later that they were right there in Dayton, Ohio, and that they would go and, you know, said, but they had no idea that the trophy was there because it wasn't on display.
Absolutely.
But, yeah.
And hidden, no telling where they had it. So at least it was logged. So at that point, it was a matter of you just discovering the trail to start on. Because I was left with when I read the information that I read, I thought it was just something that no one even knew about. So there wasn't a paper trail or anything for you to even start a discovery. So I'm glad to know that that was not the case. It made it a little easier, but still it was a challenge for you.
Well, hey, that's why I'm glad when you mentioned my book, and I will tell you, is that trophy, though, didn't come to the museum for about 20 years. So in 1949, and I'm not looking in the book right now, until at least like 1970, it was not there. It supposedly was at the Smithsonian, you know. So in my book, again, you see the email that comes to me because I'm telling them, I want to do a story about the journey of this trophy from 49 to now, you know, in 2004, you know. And that's when they're going, or we didn't have the trophy, and it's an email. I want to say they didn't get it until like at least 1970 something, but for sure more than 20 years, they told me it was at the Smithsonian. I contacted the Smithsonian. It's in my book. Here are the emails back and forth. They sent me a list of every trophy they've ever had, and it was never that trophy.
Oh.
So, I mean, it's like, so I even wrote back and said, so we don't really know what happened to the trophy. And the guy tells me then, you shouldn't be concerned about the large trophy. You should be concerned about the smaller trophy on that same table, because that smaller trophy was a unit trophy that was to stay at Lockbourne. There are two trophies on their table. Actually, let me look here what I see. Yeah.
Okay.
The second trophy was a unit trophy, was to stay at Lockbourne. But that actually why they call it the last hurrah of the Tuskegee Airmen is because the base closed. They won this event May 12, 1949. They were presented the trophy and everything. July of 49, the base, quote, was deactivated, and those men and women that were there were sent to bases throughout the world. So the small trophy, they still don't know where it is, but it was easier to find the large trophy.
Okay. I can't wait to get your book. I cannot. Say it again. Give everybody the name of that book one more time because I'm going. Is it on Amazon and Kindle or Barnes & Noble?
No.
So go ahead and tell me. How do we get the book? Because I really want it.
I self-published it. If you have to go to my website and just send me an email, the website is yourhistory101.com. And in that email, just say, Ms. Orr, I'd like to order your book. If you would like to provide your phone number, I will contact you and let you know. But I'll tell you now, the book is $24.95. I know it's not enough money for you guys, and plus shipping. So usually shipping is running about like maybe $5, $6. But the short of it is, if they go to yourhistory101.com, and the book, just tell me they want to order my book. And the name of the book is really Heroes in War, Heroes at Home, First Top Gun.
First Top Gun. I love it. And that is just what I say in my book. And I say to my audience, Top Gun is not Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Top Gun, as you have just said, is Tuskegee Airmen.
Yes.
I will be ordering your
book. Can I share, since this is Women's History Month, when you're saying so much, actually the women did so much at Tuskegee, including there were truly certified women who were mechanics. And among those women, and I'm glad I finally found out where they were educated, was at Curtis Wright in New York. I have a whole article in 1942 and in 43 where they are being trained to work on such aircraft as P-40s. And they are black women. So most people know that the women were there, and they know there were nurses, but there were women in professional capacities, like mechanics, and they really were, you know. There were some who actually riveted the aircraft, but there were some who really worked on the P-40, and there's a photo of four of them, and I got to meet one of those women who told me I was a mechanic. And, of course, when she told me that, you know, it just went straight through, like maybe she forgot and she's saying mechanic. But, you
yeah.
know, I just thought that's how I am. I like to hear a story, and I just go a step farther. Found out, sure enough, Curtis Wright in New York trained black women, and there's a whole article on it with women pictured saying they're working on P-40s and how they will be sent to different bases. So let's just know, we really, it's so much that we all are part of, especially African American, and we don't even realize the contributions we've made.
And that is my mission, Azalee. That is one of the things that I've done, and I've gotten just, I never ever thought of doing the research that I've done. I've never thought that I would produce a book, and now I'm proud to say I've got two children's books out. But it is about that, and that is my mission. It's because we do not understand the history, the black aviation history, and I think that the young kids need to know. They need to read about it, and they need to acknowledge our contribution into black aviation history. And so I just made a note of doing some research on the women, because I was proud to read about you, and we're going to be wrapping up the show, but we also have to let the audience know that you were the first female president for the Tuskegee chapter in Atlanta, Georgia, and I would like to, commend you on making that. That was, how could they not? You were the historian, and how could they not induct you into that Tuskegee Hall of Fame? So congratulations.
Wow. Thank you. Well, think about it. The chapter was founded in 1976. I became the president in 2011, so we're talking about like 35 years,
yeah.
You know, and since then I've so far still only been the only one. So women are, you know, we still are discounted in many ways.
Oh, so many ways. Absolutely, positively. We surely are. But that's okay. We are really coming up. We have our first female Asian, African-American Asian vice president. So it's slowly but surely. But we're there, and we're not going anywhere, and that's the good thing. We are not going anywhere.
Thank you. And thank you again for having me. I got a little excited, but I was trying to give you all the specifics about some of these things.
I'm going to play my own radio show back and listen to everything, because I sat here, as I said, I'm so excited to talk to you. I can't wait to meet you, and I want to hear these stories, but I will be ordering my book. As soon as we hang up, I will be calling you back and sending my pigeon with my check to your house. My carrier pigeon, I'll have him put a check in the mail right away.
and I will get that book shipped right away. So thank you again, Stacey.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. And for the audience, I hope that you enjoyed this show. I have been so excited about having Zelly on today. And once again, Zelly Orr. And please go on my website. I have all the information listed for you to be able to get your book, because I will be ordering my book, and I will, that would be my weekend reading project, because it's such an interesting story that needs to be told and it needs to be passed on. And for all of those, the young kids, if anyone, if you're out there listening, aviation is a field I am pushing, and it is my mission to make it that you will be able to be informed of the different positions that we have in aviation. We have our own black aviation history that a lot of people don't know. So for those that want to get a start on it, please start with Zelly's book and learn how this wonderful trophy, our own personal black Indiana Jones, as I have just given her the new title, to uncover this trophy. And please take some time out and read Black Aviation History. We have so much and such a big contribution that we have made to all of this. And so with that, I hope that you learned something new. I hope that you enjoyed this show. I'm so excited, as I'm always excited by every guest that I have. And I hope that you will find it interesting enough for you to come back. This is Casey Grant. And once again, this is the Fly Girl Show. And we will be back for another interesting show. My regular scheduled time is Wednesday at 11 Central Standard Time. But as you know, if I find someone interesting in between that time, I will have a show. So I'm going to sign off. Have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you, hear from you soon.